From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's time once again to present the best of Only a Game, which this time around includes the inaugural U.S. Beard and Mustache Championships, a history of the goalie mask, an auto race featuring a bunch of old guys in old cars climbing an even older hill, and a sports league for kids who have suffered trauma, abuse, and neglect. Also ahead, the story of the World War I Christmas truce observed in 1914 by soldiers who valued singing and soccer above bloodshed.
William Dawkins of the East Kent, recalled, had one of those big mouths, he meant upper-level officers, gathered together 10,000 footballs. What a happy solution that would have been without bloodshed.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As the 2010 Winter Olympics were ongoing and NBC regaled us with story after story of athletes in Vancouver seeking glory, honor, and even redemption, one group of athletes in Concord, Massachusetts sought nothing more than normalcy. Only a Game's Karen Given thought that was a story worth telling.
Every Tuesday night during basketball season, Lou Burkholz puts on a funny hat so that the kids will recognize him and walks the sidelines of the Concord Armory. Burkholz is a curriculum consultant for the Doc Wayne Athletic League, and his favorite part of his job is how normal it all seems.
I don't think you'd know this was anything other than really average high school basketball.
But look closer and you'll see the differences. Some players can't dribble, while others shoot perfect layups. Some are learning disabled, and others are serving sentences handed down by the juvenile justice system. 60% are wards of the state, 80% are survivors of physical or sexual abuse, and all of the players in the Doc Wayne League are in residential treatment, with the goal of becoming healthy enough to do things that most teenagers take for granted. Live at home, go to school, and play on a sports team.
If you take even 30 seconds just to think about what you think you might know about these kids, then I think the whole landscape opens up to what the real story is, because every single one of these kids has a story. And a story that will make you ill.
For 1 hour a week, these kids, who spend most of their days working through what they call their stuff, are asked to put those stories behind them and just play basketball. But make no mistake, playing sports in the Doc Wayne League is therapy. And that therapy sounds a little like this.
My goal for tonight is to play to the whistle, build my team, fill my tank, show up.
The Doc Wayne Athletic League teaches players life skills through common sports sayings. A coach might remind his girls to play to the whistle when they're 10 points down with just a minute to play, and he hopes that they'll remember that phrase when they're having trouble with a quiz at school. Combine that simple idea with exercise, and you have a formula that works, at least for Annika, a 14-year-old, heavily pierced, faux hawk-wearing resident of the Walden Street School in Concord.
It's really awesome. Before I was kind of angry, but, coming on the court, it makes me, it releases everything. It gives me an adrenaline rush and makes, endorphins, I guess. They're just everywhere. And, I don't know, I get really happy and excited.
Ask most of the girls in Doc Wayne why they're here, and they'll tell you they just want to have fun. But Annika has something bigger in mind.
I think my main goal is to learn to leave everything else behind. Because we are supposed to keep our heads in the game. We're not supposed to, bring all our problems with us. So I guess it just teaches me to, leave everything behind and go with the flow.
That's the kind of talk Susan Wayne likes to hear. Wayne started this league in 2002 in honor of her late brother, a pediatric surgeon called Doc. Today, about 400 kids, male and female, play basketball, soccer, softball, and flag football in the Doc Wayne League. From her borrowed office overlooking Boston's picturesque Copley Square, Wayne gets misty-eyed when thinking about the league she founded.
It's a beautiful thing to see. A number of people who I've invited will stand there sort of crying. You know, they actually have tears in their eyes. And the kids aren't crying. They're having a great time. But we're standing there crying.
Last year, Wayne commissioned Wendy DeAndrea, a postdoctoral fellow at the Justice Resource Institute's Trauma Center, to study the League. Compared to their classmates, Doc Wayne participants improved on everything from levels of depression and anxiety to talking out of turn in class and starting fights. And they needed dramatically fewer restraints. DeAndrea says these are kids who often had to fight for their survival, and even an innocent bump on the court could easily escalate.
After like two or three games like that, it was like we brought in a whole new group of kids. It was like there were kids we'd never seen before. They would knock into each other, and you know, one girl would say like, "Oh, my bad, sorry, don't know what to do with my feet," or someone else on the other team would be crying, and the other team would do a cheer for her. Like it was just incredibly sweet.
It's now a year after DeAndrea saw those results, and the girls in Concord are warming up for their last game of the regular season. This year saw far fewer growing pains, thanks in part to some changes to the rules. Craig Babineau is the athletic administrator for the Doc Wayne Athletic League and one of the referees charged with keeping the girls safe on the court. He says the kids take what they learn here back to the residences.
It's amazing when you hear the kids using the language. And they'll give it to you, too. They'll be like, if you leave a dish out by the... They're like, that's not playing to the whistle on that bowl of cereal, coach.
The lowest scoring game of the season was 2-4 after 40 minutes. Blowouts of 30-2 are relatively common. But the league's success isn't measured by the numbers on the scoreboard.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6!
Babineau points to the front court where a team calling itself the VIC, or Very Important Commits, is playing the Walden Warriors. On the Walden side, a shorter brunette named Vanessa is in constant motion.
When I first came to Walden, she was the kind of player that if someone said anything to her, there was anything in the game, she would go right after the kid, physical altercation, just very fiery like that.
Tonight, 17-year-old Vanessa hasn't lost any of her desire to win. But listening in as she addresses her team at the end of the game, you'd never know they'd lost.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Girls, you guys make me so proud. I'm, like, glad to say I was your captain this year. Like, really, you guys are amazing.
How do you think JD and I feel? Absolutely.
I just want to give everybody a high five.
Vanessa reminds everyone to go to school and, quote, suck it up when you're about to flip out. Playing in the Doc Wayne League is a privilege for these girls, and Vanessa sees it as her job to make sure everyone makes it to their next game.
I say that a lot to people. I say it to myself. Someone says something to somebody, like, people snap back. I'm just like, it's okay, like, we have a game. Don't want to, like, lose going to the game. And when I get upset, I'll be like, no, I have a game on Tuesday. I need to control myself.
It's 2.5 weeks later, and 15-year-old Maggie leads her team in a cheer before their semifinal game against the undefeated Cottage Hill Mustangs. Maggie doesn't look much like a high school basketball player, but she's introduced to me as a Doc Wayne athlete superstar, and that's exactly what she is, in every way that matters. After 2.5 years living at Germain Lawrence, a school that caters to girls battling behaviors from cutting to fire setting, Maggie has been accepted to a group home, and she credits Doc Wayne for much of her success.
We are able to really express ourselves in an athletic way instead of being criticized. Like, yeah, maybe some people don't have the most athletic ability, but they get better because the teammates that they have and the coaches and the referees that we have all really size them up and are like, you can do this if you put your heart to it. And it really kind of makes everybody just pretty much happy and confident with themselves.
Maggie says she was a couch potato when she first started playing in Doc Wayne, and now she's proud to call herself an athlete. She also says she's learned things that go far beyond the basketball court.
If you knock somebody over and help them back up, that's definitely, like, not only a good thing on the court, but also when you're walking through, like, the street. If you bump into somebody, be like, oh, I'm sorry, or, like,
you know, in the classroom, be like, you need some help with this.
And is that something you didn't realize when you first came to the school?
That is something I had no idea of.
Tonight's semifinal goes into overtime, the length of which is determined by how much time remains before the league gets shooed out of the gym. After trading the lead, the Mustangs win, final score 26-22. Despite the hard loss, Maggie is still grinning from ear to ear, and her coach Betty is still singing the team's praises.
You guys played this game out until the end. Like, you guys definitely played to the whistle, to the end, all the way to the end on every possession right there, and you guys should be very proud of yourselves.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
All right, girls, remember, nothing but good game, okay? Here we go. Nothing but good game. Good
game. Our games are everywhere. Some of them are big and some are small, and certainly some are rigged, which is what I'd always thought about the one that challenges you to operate by means of a lever, a mechanical claw that lurches around in a plastic booth and looks as if it might descend, pick up a colorful stuffed animal, and drop it into a chute from which it would slide into your hands. These arcade-type games are not limited to arcades, and the other day I encountered one next to the cashier's counter at a restaurant on an interstate highway in Maine. It seemed a cruel thing, because any poor clown taking his family into the place for bad food served indolently would have to walk his kids past this game at least twice, and all of them were sure to want to operate the claw, which is what the little blonde girl, maybe 2½, wanted while I was standing nearby. Okay, her father said, and my spirit sank. Now would come failure. Certainly the father and daughter would be able to maneuver the claw into the vicinity of the animal the little girl wanted, a bright yellow dog, as it turned out, and just as certainly the claw would let slip the dog before it could be coaxed over to the spot above the chute that would have delivered it into the little girl's hands. As father and daughter pushed and pulled the lever, father trying heroically to guide without taking charge, I looked at the cashier. Her eyes were sad. She knew what was coming. I should have a box of stuffed animals behind the counter so I can give something to the kids, she said. They never win. Doggy, said the little blonde girl. Hold on, said her father. But I never remember to pick up the stuffed animals, said the cashier. Daddy, shouted the little girl. You got it, said her father. And then again, because I don't think he could believe it either, you got it. As if operating according to some impossibly humane impulse, impossible for a mechanical claw, certainly, the machine had dropped the yellow stuffed dog into the chute, down which, smiling eternally, it slid. The little girl and her father caught the dog together before it could hit the floor. "Go show Mommy," the dad said. "Mommy!" shrieked the child, racing back into the restaurant. The father looked astonished, but no more astonished than the cashier. To no one in particular, she said, "That was good." It's 19 minutes past the hour. If you're a pro basketball fan, what you want to do is you want to get your Christmas out of the way early, by noon at the latest, because at noon on Christmas Day, Chicago plays New York. It's Boston at Orlando at 2:30 Eastern and Miami at the Lakers at 5, neither of which you can miss for reasons that, if I have to explain them, you're probably not going to understand. Then you got Denver at Oklahoma City at 8, Portland at Golden State at 10:30. You watch them, God bless them, every one. So instead of Christmas dinner, you might want to be thinking Christmas breakfast, and then a second cup of coffee if there's time, and then turn on the games. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Old guys in old cars taking Ancient Hill by storm. But first, the Pacific Northwest just happens to be a stronghold for full-length bushy beards. So it's only fitting that the first ever Beard Team USA National Beard and Mustache Championships should take place in Oregon. Sadie Babbitts was at the inaugural event in June 2010, and she brought us tales of bearded glory.
Please welcome Idaho!
More than 200 men parade onto the stage at the outdoor amphitheater in Bend. But instead of swimsuits and talent competitions, here at the Nationals, it's all about flowing beards and sculpted mustaches.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Illinois!
Some contestants sport dapper suits, top hats, and full-length beards and curled mustaches. Others rock cut-off Levi's and t-shirts. Their beards are styled into crazy creations. One man has his beard shaped to hold two beer cans. Another has twigs woven into his bushy beard with little birds attached at the end. John Benedict came all the way from Boulder, Colorado to compete in his first beard competition. He calls himself the Corn King.
I'm wearing a crown of corn husks. I've got a corn cob at the end of a scepter. And I've got my beard cornrowed, which to my knowledge may never have been done.
He hopes this beard will give him an edge in the freestyle category. That's where pretty much anything goes.
As for cornrowing, that was the will of the people. I crowdsourced my beard this year. So what I did was actually just I solicited ideas from anyone who wanted to submit them, anyone who had an idea of what they could do, you know. Basically, unbearded people who couldn't be represented are now represented.
It took 4 hours to braid all those cornrows and 11 months to grow his dark brown beard. Others like John Macy have been at this a lot longer. Macy's been growing his beard for 30 years.
It's long. It's fairly heavy. Over the years, it turned from black to gray to white.
What made you decide that you wanted to keep growing this beard for 30 years?
Well, you just never knew when to trim.
He flew in from the Virgin Islands just for the Nationals and a shot at $1,000 in the full beard category. He's been at this a while, co-founding a Beard Team USA chapter on the island of St. Croix. The club has already held two contests. Macy says these competitions come down to two things.
It has to do with beards and beer.
It may be all about the beer, but it may not necessarily be all about the beards. There are plenty of men sporting mustaches, too. Some, like Keith Hombrick, are considered professionals. This Seattle waiter looks like he should actually be an Italian painter with his black fedora and flamboyant silk shirt. He sculpted his black mustache into, get this, scissors. I ask him how he did it.
Mustache wax and a little imagination. And they're scissors, right? You would be my worst nightmare, so I'm tackling my fears.
You know, because scissors cut facial hair, and in the wrong hands, they can really do some damage. Call it a bit of irony, but Hombrick, who goes by Gandhi Jones on the stage, has played with similar themes and won. 2 years ago at the Worlds in Alaska, he turned his mustache into a spoon and fork. Before that, he turned that same mustache into cat whiskers.
I love being creative, and I've already won two world championships as the freestyle mustache category.
This year, he's decided to compete in the traditional mustache category, right along with handlebar twisted mustaches. But Hombrick says this mustache is more than for show. It's about fashion and a style Hombrick hopes is making a comeback.
The 80s have not been kind to facial hair. The 70s seems to have been kind for mustaches and 60s for beards. So I guess maybe it's just, you know, the cyclical nature of fashion and style.
But the real excitement over facial hair and competitions really picked up 4 years ago after the World Beard and Mustache Championships in England. The U.S. beat out long-standing facial hair icon Germany in several categories, including imperial mustache and natural full beard. 2 years later at the Worlds in Alaska, the U.S. took most of the trophies. Beard Team USA's national competition is a nod to the fact that American facial hair glory is here to stay.
I'm Jack Passion, and I'm a two-time world beard champion.
Passion is a rock star among beardsmen. He's been a pro for 5 years now, competing with his red beard that reaches his waistline.
You know, as facial hair and bearding gets more serious in America, this is a stage for weeding out the men from the also men. When you have a great beard next to a great beard, the judges have to pick. It's such subtle details that distinguish the two. And oftentimes, it's just the attitude.
The judges also look at beard and mustache style, sheen, and how a man presents himself on stage. It's a tough job breaking each of the four categories down to 15 finalists. And it's even harder to pick the final three winners in full beard, mustache, freestyle, and partial beard. Backstage, the men drink beer as a lone woman does any needed touch-ups. A little wax there on that mustache or a bit of hairspray there.
So in a couple seconds, we're going to bring up everybody in the mustache category. Everybody from the mustache category is going to go up on stage in just 2 seconds. I'll let you know.
Dozens of men waltz back on stage.
All right, let's do it, guys! Mustaches!
The finalists include Keith Hombrick, a.k.a. Gandhi Jones. He's the one with the mustache waxed into the shape of scissors. He strides down the catwalk, snapping real scissors, one in each hand.
We have our results, and it's time to honor these beards and mustaches.
The men seem nervous, but no one holds hands or breaks down in tears.
Third place at the first ever Beard Team USA National Beard and Mustache Championships in the mustache division. Please step forward, Gandhi Jones.
The reigning Miss Oregon and one of the judges hands Keith Hombrick a rather conservative-looking crystal trophy. A Bend resident takes second, and first place goes to California resident Larry McClure. He has a white Victorian handlebar mustache that's at least a foot long.
When they told me, you know, they announced my name, I didn't think, you know, that I was even, I thought I was a contestant. But when they went clear through the thing and they announced my name, I was really surprised. I was shocked.
And I have to say, the crowd loved you.
I know it. It was deafening up there on that stage. I couldn't believe it.
Do you ever hit the handlebars on stuff? Or,
yes, I do.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I hit them on doors. I was talking to my wife, and I was rolling through the power windows in her car. And I went like that, and I got stuck in the damn window.
It took a year and a half for McClure to get his mustache this long. Now at 67, he's thinking maybe he'll enter another contest. Beard Team USA is already plotting next year's championships. Meanwhile, several of the contestants in Bend plan to take their facial hair next year to the Worlds in Norway to continue their quest for the ultimate facial hair honor. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
This is the tale of two cars, or at least in part, it's that sort of tale, and one of the cars is a 1936 Bentley Le Mans Special. It is owned and driven by Frank Walcott, who also restored it, and it features, among other things, a handcrafted wooden rear-mounted toolbox, which didn't strike me as standard equipment.
No, actually I made that. The tire went right back up to the end, and I didn't like the line, so I did that.
Frank Walcott has done all the rest of the work on this Bentley as well.
Chrome is not chrome, it's all nickel, which is very expensive to do and maintain. The body is leather, as you can see, covered over wood, and that made the car much lighter than steel.
This is the actual outside of the body is leather.
You can feel it with your hand there, it's leather.
It is leather, and the Bentley Le Mans Special looks pretty much as it must have looked on the showroom floor in 1936, except for that handcrafted toolbox. What should shine on the car shines, and the driver's seat looks as if nobody's ever eaten a donut in it. Even the engine gleams, all of which no doubt strikes Sandy Leith, who is standing beside a partially blue Bugatti sports car, as perverse and altogether wrong.
This is a car I found in a barn 15 years ago.
And you wouldn't paint this, right?
I would not. I love it the way it is. They can only look that way once. People try to fake that appearance now. That's the real deal.
You mean like distressed jeans?
Yeah, absolutely. They call it patinating, and it's you can tell when they've been patinated. They just don't look quite right.
So you have two choices if you're going to own one of these cars. You either present it as the beat-up car that it is, or you lovingly restore it to what it would have looked like in 1932 or 1928.
That's correct.
all of the cars, perhaps two dozen in all, parked at the top of Honeywell Hill in Wellesley, Massachusetts, on this sunny May morning, look wonderful in their way. But appearance is only part of the reason their owners and drivers have gathered at the top of the driveway that snakes up into the Honeywell estate. This morning marks the 40th anniversary of the Honeywell Hill Climb, during which each of these Bentleys and Bugattis and Rileys will roar one at a time from the bottom to the top of the road, where somebody will punch a stopwatch. Among those for whom this tradition has never grown old is Sarah Rowe. She and her son brought two cars to Honeywell Hill from Maine.
I've always loved old cars, and I've been doing this hill for 30 years.
30 of the 40?
Yeah, yeah. And I started doing it with my Riley, and when my husband died 10 years ago, I brought the Bugatti, because this was his, and now it's mine.
The Bugatti certainly looked fast, so as her son started the adjacent Riley, I asked Ms. Rowe if she was a contender.
No, I'm not going to win, because there are a lot more powerful cars than mine, apart from anything else. But I just take into account the fact that I'm the only woman.
So you win your division.
Yes, but we don't get prizes anyway, so anyway, we need to start our engines.
Almost none of the drivers I spoke with before the racing began felt they could win, though some of them had certainly taken power into account when they rebuilt their cars. Consider, for example, Hall Fillinger and his 1912 Mercedes.
I found the car, or the remains of the car, in the early 90s. The engine is the focal point of the car. The engine is a 9.5-liter World War I Hall Scott airplane engine. And
that sounds fast.
It is. However, you do have to be very careful because it only has rear wheel brakes. So you want to drive about 3 or 4 car lengths ahead because you need some stopping power. It's a ferociously fast car.
Eventually, it was time for the cars, ferociously fast and otherwise, to wind their way back down the hill to the starting line. But not before Sandy Leith, who took over the task of organizing the hill climb from his father 20 years ago, issued some last-minute instructions.
As you probably saw coming up, the course is a little wet, so we're not going to push it this morning. Just find the line. It's very ridged, shouldered on the corner, on the edges of the pavement. So don't put a wheel wrong because it could be disastrous. Helmet required, please. No passengers. Seat belt, if you have one.
Clear at the top. Ready to go.
Ready at the top.
Ready at the top.
As I watched the cars cough and clatter by, most of them covering the distance in between 35 and 50 seconds, I noticed a woman who was meticulously recording the results of each run. It turned out that Carol Bragg's relationship to the event was more than casual.
My husband, Ben, is one of the hill climb people. Performers, what do you call them? Racers?
So when it's his turn...
And I get stuck doing the times.
Yeah, but when it's his turn, no matter what, you write down 27 seconds, right?
That is not correct. I do not cheat, but he does hold the course record. Last year he set it.
And by golly, with his wife here at the scorer's table, he'll probably keep it.
I hope so.
For the record, after the 40th running of the climb, Carol Bragg's husband Ben did still hold the record at Honeywell Hill. Though he has no trophy, no medal, no tangible reward at all to show for this distinction, he has earned, as another competitor told me, the adulation of dozens. On that sunny, albeit somewhat noisy day at the top of that hill in Wellesley, it seemed somehow sufficient. You're listening to Only a Game. Zhengjie. That's how you spell the name of the 27-year-old tennis star out of China who beat 11th seed Marion Bartoli in the third round of the 2010 Australian Open. If you had been watching the BBC, you might think her name is pronounced something like this.
Fell to China's Zhengjie, ranked 100.
But since that YouTube video was identified as a BBC fail, I thought I might need some help. It seemed like a job for...
the two Chinese characters.
John Weinstein and Carsi Yi are the two Chinese characters. They taught me to properly say Beijing as the 2008 Summer Olympics began. And in January 2010, I asked them to help me pronounce the name of the female tennis player currently ranked number 26 in the world.
Okay, the first thing you're going to have to do is stick your tongue out.
Right.
No one's watching, so
that's
great. Now you want to curl it backwards.
Uh-huh.
And then put that up against the roof of your mouth.
I got it.
And now you pretty much just want to say an English J sound. So now just say gong.
Gong.
Beautiful.
It's all about the tongue, Bill.
And then for the second part, the tongue has to come forward. So right behind your teeth, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, Carsi, that BBC fail video on YouTube is from a few years ago. Have Western sports broadcasters made any progress in pronouncing this young woman's name?
I'd have to say no. Pretty much every broadcaster says it differently.
Oh.
And sometimes the same sportscaster will say it differently every time he or she says it.
Do you think there's something to that? Is it like a Chinese pronunciation Rorschach test of sorts?
That's up there with reading tea leaves, and that's not part of my skill set.
Zheng Jia is ranked 35th in the world. I'm wondering, why hasn't her countrywoman, Li Na, currently ranked 17th, been the focus of your pronunciation efforts?
Well, Li Na is blessed with having a name that's actually quite easy to say, and I don't know if that's...
You mean I got it right the first time?
Yes, you did.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you are immensely talented and much more experienced now in Chinese pronunciation, but that was beautiful.
And surprisingly, Bill, this is not a problem in China. Apparently, people in China don't have any difficulty pronouncing her name.
So even if she sinks to, like, number 124, they'll get it right.
They'll still say it properly. I don't know if they'll love her quite as much.
Carsi Yi and John Weinstein are the two Chinese characters. Guys, thanks again.
You're welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
At the very least, say jung like jungle. It's really pretty hard to bungle.
Zheng Jie. Zheng Jie.
If you'd like to leave a comment about something you heard on Only a Game, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at Nuance.com. This is NPR.
Just before Christmas is no time for a reindeer to be thinking vacation, but apparently a 9-year-old reindeer in the Hopper Brothers Christmas tree lot in Santa Maria, California, hadn't looked at the calendar. The reindeer left the Christmas tree lot in favor of a romp through nearby Santa Maria streets, residential areas, and strawberry fields, albeit not forever. That's because rancher Bob Akistapache was on the job. He hopped aboard his horse, lassoed the potential puller of Santa's sleigh, and tied the reindeer to a lamppost. Eventually, the reindeer was packed into a trailer and trucked back to Hopper Brothers, where one presumes he was available to Santa if necessary.
And then away went Rudolph, whizzing like a shooting star. Run, run, Rudolph, Santa lets you make it in town.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the Christmas truce that temporarily halted World War I. But first, imagine a hard black hockey puck hurtling toward you. Now imagine that puck hitting you right in the face. That's exactly what often happened to goalies for decades until 1959, when one netminder decided it was time for a change. Only a Game's Doug Trabue reports.
Montreal Canadiens goaltender Jacques Plante should have been happy. It was the fall of 1959. His team was beginning its quest for a fifth straight Stanley Cup, and Plante was coming off his fourth season as an NHL All-Star. But Plante was fed up with being hit in the face with hockey pucks. Fred Addis is a member of the Society for International Hockey Research.
He had fractured each of his cheekbones once and had his nose broken twice and had totaled some 150 stitches before the 1959-60 season opened.
On November 1st, Plante and the Canadiens were in New York. a ranger's shot hit Plant in the nose and mouth, leaving cuts that required stitches. When he returned to the game, his face was hidden behind a form-fitting fiberglass mask. The future Hall of Famer would wear a mask for the rest of his career. According to Addis, Canadian goalies had been experimenting with masks long before Plant, including a female goaltender in Ontario who tried a fencing mask in 1926. The story of Plant's innovative fiberglass mask begins at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York. Don Spencer played goalie for the Hamilton hockey team in the late 1950s. Hamilton's athletic trainer and track coach, Gene Long, had been developing fiberglass heel cups for his high and long jumpers. Spencer says he asked Long for help after an injury in the fall of 1958.
I had a slap shot go off my ankle bone and just wouldn't heal up, and he made a fiberglass plate. After that, he obviously got thinking about his applicability as far as being a potential technique for developing a face mask.
In early 1959, Spencer and Gene Long began talking about making a fiberglass mask. Long says the original process began with plaster of Paris, and it was especially unpleasant for claustrophobic goalies.
For it meant that you covered up the whole face except for, you know, possibly a straw in the mouth to breathe, or leaving the mouth ajar while you covered this whole face with essentially a cast.
By the time Long had finished Spencer's mask, Hamilton's season was over. But around that time, Spencer heard about another goalie in the market for some facial protection.
In mid-April, there was an article in a newspaper talking about the fact that Jacques Plante, who had also been chewed up pretty badly that season, so that he was beginning to look for a face mask. And so I wrote Jacques Plante about that process and hoped for a response.
Spencer never heard back, but researcher Fred Addis believes Spencer's letter prompted Plante to abandon the problematic plexiglass shields many goalies had begun using in practice. Over the years, some reports have erroneously credited Plante with creating the fiberglass mask, which was actually made by a fiberglass salesman named Bill Birchmore. Birchmore and Plante are deceased, and it's not clear how they met. Addis says they later formed a mask-making business, and Birchmore helped pioneer other styles, including the pretzel mask, which featured bars. Jerry Cheevers wore a white fiberglass mask during a career spent mostly with the Boston Bruins between 1965 and 1980. The Hall of Famer played on two Stanley Cup championship teams, but his biggest contribution to the game might be his mask. Cheevers came to practice one day thinking about how to get out of practice and how to decorate his shield. A relatively soft shot off the fiberglass solved both problems. Cheevers faked an injury and asked a trainer to come up with something to prove he'd been hurt.
So he takes his magic mark and paints a huge stitch, like a 12-inch scar in the mask. So we got, and I said, see, I was very seriously hurt, and we got a little chuckle out of it. And I said, this is a good idea. I finally answered the question of how I'm going to decorate my mask.
Cheevers continued adding stitches whenever a puck hit his mask, sometimes even putting them on between periods, and soon it was covered. The image became so iconic that Cheevers now has a business selling signed mounted replicas. Today's masks bear no resemblance to Plante's original. The current models are more like helmets and often feature elaborate artwork on the entire shell. Dominic Malerba owns Pro's Choice Goalie Masks in Middleton, Massachusetts, and has been making customized masks for pros and amateurs for 20 years. His NHL clients have included Mike Smith, Andy Moog, Mike Richter, and Olaf Kolzig. The slapshots of today's top defensemen, like Boston's Zdeno Chara, routinely break 100 miles an hour. Malerba says that's why goalies need better technology.
Not too long ago, but maybe a couple weeks ago when the Bruins were playing Edmonton, Chara went down the middle with a slap shot and hit Habby Boulin, one of my guys, straight in the face, and he didn't even flinch.
Malerba's NHL masks cost approximately $2,200 apiece. After Gene Long made his first mask in 1959, word spread and his hobby turned into a small side business. Long says it took him 3 5-hour days to make each one, and it wasn't all that profitable.
Quite frankly, it was my Christmas money for my three growing girls. I started out selling these masks at $25 each, mostly for high school and college goalies. I don't think that they ever got as expensive as $50. So it was Christmas money and fun.
But when Jacques Plante first donned Bill Birchmore's mask during an NHL game, it wasn't a fun transition. Many coaches, players, and team executives, even within the Canadiens organization, criticized Plante and feared that masks would create distance in the relationship between fans and their favorite players. But hockey researcher Fred Addis says while some goalies took years to come around, Plante's stature in the game helped masks gain acceptance.
He was the best goalie by far in the National Hockey League, and when the best goalie in the league puts on something as innovative as a face mask, obviously people are going to follow suit. In one season, they were unacceptable and only worn by cowards. In the following season, there were hockey organizations that were mandating their players to wear them.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabu.
Take off that mask. Don't think you should show your face around here. So if you got through, you know it's not the end of the world. Take off that mask. It's okay. There's friends around here.
On Christmas Eve, 1914, a gruesome war was briefly interrupted by a number of spontaneous truces. Up and down the battle line that stretched across western France, groups of combatants, the Germans on one side, the English and their allies on the other, met in no man's land to acknowledge Christmas. They listened to each other sing carols, they traded gifts, and on the pocked fields between their respective lines of barbed wire and filthy trenches, they played soccer. In Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas truce, Stanley Weintraub recounts tales of those unlikely events which were dismissed as an aberration of no consequence in the official histories of the war because the truce only lasted a matter of hours and because the war went on for four more years. In December of 2002, I spoke with Mr. Weintraub and asked him if the Christmas truce should have been so dismissed.
It was of utterly no consequence as far as ending the war was concerned. But had the war ended at that time, there would have been perhaps 20 million fewer dead. A generation of young men would not have been wiped out. Perhaps the world would have been a great deal different. We have no way of knowing. But it represents something else, too. It seems to me to be the last gasp of chivalry in wartime, the last gasp of real brotherhood, the recognition that the people on the other side were like you. And one of the most famous songs remembering the Christmas truce is one by John McCutcheon called Christmas in the Trenches. In it, a trooper from Liverpool says that one thing we learned in the Christmas truce was that on both ends of the rifle we're the same. And I don't think that recognition has occurred since.
Then one by one on either side walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet, we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave them hell.
It's probably hard for most people today to imagine how dreadful the conditions in the trenches during World War I were. You quote one German artist who calls the battlefront the work of the devil.
Yes, this was Otto Dix, described the landscape of fortified ditches as lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, shells, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets, mortars, fire, steel. That's what war is, he said. It's the work of the devil. And the troops were grateful for this interlude to celebrate Christmas. It was certainly spontaneous. The governments had no idea that this was going to happen. When they encouraged a bit of morale-boosting gifts to be sent to the troops, and the Germans even sent small Christmas trees, the British were first baffled and then mesmerized by seeing those lights like footlights in a theater across the expanse of no man's land. And it was not a big expanse. No man's land wasn't any wider than the width of a football field from spectators on one side to spectators on the other.
Right.
That meant that the troops could hear each other, could see each other, even shoot at each other almost point blank. It was death to raise your head above a trench. But the Germans, with their Christmas trees, not only lit the candles on the trees, but began singing Silent Night. And the British recognized Silent Night. It was their song, too. And pretty soon, carols and other songs began wafting across the trenches from side to side. You couldn't have done anything in No Man's Land, even at the time of the truce, without getting rid of the corpses. No Man's Land might have been only 65 or 70 yards wide, but over the weeks of war, it had filled with corpses. Christmas morning, they buried the bodies jointly. There were moving informal services. Both sides recognized that they knew the 23rd Psalm. It was repeated in German and in English. The bodies were buried. And once the bodies were buried, they had a football pitch, a soccer pitch.
They had a place where they could play soccer. And whose idea was it initially to have a competition at soccer?
I think it happened spontaneously up and down the line. It was the working man's game.
Mm-hmm.
They longed for that opportunity. The Scott troops kilted in that terrible weather. The Scott troops even brought soccer balls into the trenches and hoped for a chance to use them.
You write of the war itself, quote, "Both sides were misled by half-truths. Beneath the artificial hatred, each respected the other. Victory, if it came at all, would be long delayed, costly, and worthless. Perhaps a football match, after which both sides went home, might be a better solution." And I gather there were soldiers on both sides who felt that way.
Yes, William Dawkins of the East Kents recalled, "It was told to me that our lieutenant colonel threatened our soldiers with machine guns. Mm. Had one of those big mouths," he meant upper-level officers, "gathered together 10,000 footballs, what a happy solution that would have been without bloodshed."
What a beautiful thought.
Of course, it didn't happen. There were nearly four more years of war, three more Christmases of war. There never was another Christmas truce. There hasn't been another one in the history of warfare before or since. And millions died and nothing gained because the peace led to another war in 1939, the Second World War.
Of the truce, at one point in the book, you write, "Christmas 1914 evokes the stubborn humanity within us and suggests an unrealized potential." I know you wrote those words some years ago, but I wonder if you feel they have particular meaning once again now.
I think they have meaning that is ironic in the circumstances, because we can only have truces of the sort that were celebrated by those men in 1914 at Christmas when you have a common culture across the no man's land, when the troops believe in the same thing, have the same backgrounds roughly. And you could do that then because not only did both sides sing Silent Night, for example, the Germans were even able to sing Tipperary in German back to the British. And but how can you do that with a culture that is alien? I was a young officer in the Korean War. We had no common contacts. They didn't talk our language. They didn't look like us. They didn't sound like us. There was nothing we had that was in any way compatible. The same thing could certainly be said of a potential war in Iraq or a potential war anywhere where there isn't a commonality of culture.
There is the commonality of soccer, though, interestingly enough. The Koreans play soccer. The Iraqis play soccer. The U.S., the English, they all play soccer. There
yes,
is kind of the hope of that kind of commonality, perhaps.
It is the world game, certainly. When they talk about the World Cup, it means something about soccer. But I don't recall any attempt to play soccer between the two sides in Korea. I was there for two Christmases during the war. Nothing like that ever happened. I don't know if that attempt was even thought of. Maybe now that there has been a revival of interest in that Christmas truce, we'll think about that again.
That was Stanley Weintraub talking with me in December of 2002 about his book Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce, published by Plume Press.
We shared some secret brandy and wished each other well. And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave him hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Young Sanders played his squeeze box and they had a violin. This curious and unlikely band of men.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our goalie mask, Doc Wayne League, or Honeywell Hill photos, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from folk singer John McCutcheon.
Oh, my name is Francis Tolliver. In Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas comes since World War I. I've learned its lessons well. But the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame. And on each end of the rifle, we're the same.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.